So in the last couple of days, Sayadaw has given detailed instructions on how to do the practice, as well as some background information about the Metta Sutta and about the qualities of metta that we're cultivating when we do this practice. Today, I want to back up a little bit and to give you some context about the practice and the form of the practice. In the reports in the last couple of days, a number of people have come to us, people who are more used to Vipassana practice, with questions about how these two practices fit together, how to do this as opposed to that. Various questions about metta practice, Vipassana practice, metta bhavana, Vipassana bhavana. So today I want to more fully describe the relationship between these two and the relationship between this practice which develops concentration and metta and our insight practice, our Vipassana practice. How the processes differ, a little about how they support each other, and a few words about how each works with difficulties, these difficult mind states that arise, regardless of what practice we do. Sayadaw spoke yesterday about the framing story of the Metta Sutta, and we've been chanting the English version, or one English version of the Metta Sutta in the evening. And in this beautiful, very condensed teaching, at the very end, the Buddha really hints at the interrelationship between cultivating metta and liberating freedom, liberating insight. Hints at the relationship between metta bhavana and vipassana bhavana, but in quite a condensed way. The last two verses of the Metta Sutta, and this is a different English translation, one by Andy Olensky, who's a Pali scholar in the East Coast of the U.S. The last two verses say this: as long as one is devoid of torpor, one would resolve upon this mindfulness. This is known as the sublime abiding here. Without falling into mistaken views, endowed with insight and integrity, guiding away greed for sensual things, one would not be born again into the world. That last line is an indirect reference to Nibbana, to Arahata Magapala Nibbana, where one is fully liberated and no longer reborn into any existence at all. So this follows that whole sutta of talking about cultivating metta and says, so long as you're not sleepy, do this all the time. One would resolve upon this mindfulness. And that's the Pali word in the sutta itself, sati. And that directly points to the fact that liberating insight requires more than just concentration that's developed in the metta practice. We can't directly become liberated by doing just metta bhavana. It also needs wisdom, panya, which of course is what we develop in the Vipassana practice. And these two are developed through and by means of sati, mindfulness. So metta bhavana by itself does not lead to liberating insight, but it definitely goes in that direction. And when we resolve upon this mindfulness and also cultivate wisdom, both metta and panya, then liberating insight is possible. Metta bhavana, the cultivation of metta, and vipassana bhavana, the cultivation of vipassana, do not exist as little islands in isolation from each other. They are deeply and very naturally interconnected. And before I say anything more about this, I really want to speak a little bit about samatha practice as opposed to vipassana practice. As Saito said at the outset, and as you know very well right now, by now experientially, metta bhavana is a samatha practice. It cultivates concentration. And this is quite different from a practice that cultivates insight, vipassana bhavana. A samatha practice develops one pointedness of mind. Vipassana bhavana, the practice leading to insight, develops a fluid awareness that deeply understands the nature of reality. Ultimately, this fluid awareness leads to an understanding of the nature of form, of mind objects, and the direct realization of Nibbana. So these practices have different intentions and different goals. With samatha practice, we're cultivating unity of mind, one-pointedness. Generally, in this case, unwholesome mind states are suppressed by this one-pointedness. They cannot arise because the mind is sticking to a wholesome object. The mind is fixed on a wholesome object. With vipassana bhavana, there's a diversity of moment-to-moment awareness of whatever is predominant in our experience. It's very fluid, it's very dynamic, rather than being fixed. And it's only with vipassana bhavana that unwholesome mind states are uprooted as opposed to suppressed temporarily. So when we do a concentration practice, we attain states of mind where unwholesome mind states are very far away. But it's like putting a wet blanket on a smoldering fire. The moment you take that blanket away and give it, you know, air and light, it can come up again. But with vipassana bhavana, the entire tendency for any of these states to re-arise is what is uprooted. And metta bhavana as a samatha practice is actually a special case, because not only are we developing one-pointedness of mind, fixity of mind, but we're also developing the quality of metta in the heart, in the mind. We're not using some neutral object like an image, a colored disc. The sensations that we pay attention to if we're doing anapana, the sensations at the nostril. We're actually developing this wholesome mind state of metta. We're developing the habit of going there again and again and again. And this profoundly changes the mind stream. Somebody mentioned in their report today, and I thought it was very touching, from the last time he'd been at a metta retreat here to now, he said he hadn't been doing much practice at all. And he was so surprised the moment he sat down and began to practice how quickly the mind dropped back into this habitual groove of metta. And that's what happens when we do this practice. We develop that fixity and that habit of going to this wholesome mind state. And so we're doing both of these at the same time. It happens together. And when this quality of metta is developed to a great extent, it does purify the mind stream. It changes the mind. And comparing metta bhavana and vipassana bhavana, we can say really that one enters the doorway of Dhamma through conventional reality, metta bhavana. We use these categories of beings. We use the relationships of our lives as the doorway into the Dhamma. Whereas vipassana uses ultimate reality as the doorway to the Nibbana. Understanding clearly as they really are, mind and matter. And if you think of Nibbana as a mountain, they're like paths coming from the opposite sides. It looks really, really different when you do this practice as opposed to that practice. In the metta practice, it's important to realize that although we use these conventional categories as the way in, we're actually not reinforcing them. We're not reinforcing these conventional perceptions necessarily. But we're using them in the service of releasing self-centered connection, releasing clinging, craving, aversion. And there's more to be said about this in further talks. But the purification that happens with this metta practice, it changes the mind because we release our tendency to think first about ourselves and then about other people and how there can be such a big difference between that. So that's basically insight versus concentration in this context of the metta bhavana, in brief. In the context of vipassana retreats in the West, many of you know this very well, metta bhavana is often relegated to kind of a token sitting in the afternoon. You do a metta sitting at 2 o'clock to kind of break up the day, a little entertainment for everybody. But here in Burma, it's really seen as a powerful adjunct to the vipassana practice, a powerful support to the vipassana practice, and a great protection. It directly influences the development of insight. And Sayadaw spoke about the framing story yesterday. He said, you know, how the Buddha said, oh, you didn't have a weapon. Here's your weapon. In that same story, there's another version of it that where the Buddha said, this is your practice and your protection. So it's both a weapon and a protection. It protects the mind and heart, and it supports the vipassana bhavana. So I'll spend much of the rest of the time today talking about how it does that, how it supports, what it does to support the vipassana bhavana. And that all boils down to two things, mindfulness and wisdom. So first, the relationship between metta as a state of mind and sati, mindfulness. Developing the quality of metta as you're doing by repeating the phrase and connecting with the meaning of the phrase and directing that towards another person or towards yourself, developing metta in this way requires mindfulness. So even though metta bhavana is a samatha practice, it indirectly, kind of in the background, develops our mindfulness, develops the continuity of mindfulness. And of course, mindfulness is the primary tool that we use for the development in the vipassana practice of insight of wisdom. Without mindfulness, wisdom cannot arise. But likewise, without mindfulness, metta cannot arise. Both. So there's this inherent relationship between loving kindness and mindfulness. They're absolutely not the same thing, but experientially, and a couple of people have already said this, when you have one, it feels like you automatically have the other. They can feel like two sides of the same coin. In the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, both sati, mindfulness, and adosa, a lack of aversion, in other words, metta, are both described as beautiful mental factors, universally present in each moment of completely purified consciousness. So when the consciousness is completely purified, we have both mindfulness and metta. So the total development of each automatically brings along the other. And directly and indirectly, the intentional development of metta, as we're doing, as I said, actually requires the development of mindfulness. As it says in that line in the Metta Sutta, one would resolve upon this mindfulness. How does that happen? Think about it in your own experience. You're sitting here. You connect with the heart center, with yourself sitting here. You begin to repeat the phrase. You connect with the meaning of the phrase. And then you radiate it, you incline it towards either yourself or one of your benefactors. Connect with that other person, either with a felt sense or an image. Each of these things, this connection with the heart center, the connection with the phrase, the connection with the person, each of these forms of connection is actually a form of mindfulness. So really connecting with the meaning of the phrase that you're using, with the felt sense or the image of the person that you're radiating the metta towards. And the metta feeling absolutely requires a kind of attentiveness, which is another facet of the mindfulness that we develop in Vipassana Bhavana. In this context, I use the word attentiveness because it really captures that aspect of sati that we develop here in the metta bhavana. It functions to keep whatever object we're connecting with it with fully in mind, whether it's the image of the person, whether it's the meaning of the phrase. What's common with vipassana is the necessity of having a mind that actually remembers what it's doing, rather than drifting off here and there. And as many of you know, the root meaning of the word sati is to remember. So what's common with vipassana and metta as practices, Vipassana bhavana, metta bhavana, what's common with the form of mindfulness that we're developing in both is that there is this attentiveness that knows what the mind needs to do and keeps going in that direction, staying connected. And that mindful connection is what's so essential in this practice. It's what keeps us coming back again and again and again. And knowing when we've drifted off, remembering to come back. It's actually very much the same thing that happens when we develop a continuity of awareness in the Vipassana practice. We become aware of, it's like, oh, I've been away with the fairies for 10 minutes, and we begin again. It's the same here. Of course, it's quite different once we come back and begin again. Here, there's a fixity of where we put the mind. There, it's very fluid. But it requires that attentiveness. It requires that ability to keep beginning again and to know when we've gone off. So even though it's not the deep and penetrative mindfulness that we need to develop in the Vipassana practice, this attentiveness that we're developing here really, really benefits the Vipassana practice. I really think of it as cross-training. So if you're running marathons, it really helps to get on a bike or to swim, to develop the body in a different way that doesn't require so much pounding of joints on the road, develops different muscle memory, develops different fitness that directly influences the ability to run. In the same way, we cross-train for Vipassana by doing metta practice. Because in the Vipassana, as I've just said, we also have to connect again and again and again and again in a moment-to-moment way. But as I said, in both cases, we need to be able to do this. So in this way, as you're just sitting here, repeating the phrase, coming back, and connecting, 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 you're developing sati in the background. And you're strengthening the habit of being present. And that directly transfers to the Vipassana practice. So it's a very different practice, of course. But it, you know, some people, the first time they do metta bhavana, I know this was certainly the case for me, it was so disconcerting not to be paying attention to something, not to be mindful. And I thought, oh, ugh. You know, when I finally get to do Vipassana again, I'm really going to, it's not going to be easy to connect in the way that I'm used to. I found that not to be the case. I was really wrong. So, no fear. You know, this really does benefit the Vipassana practice. And beyond the development of sati, I like to think of metta bhavana as providing us a backdoor into panya, into wisdom. Cultivating metta, as you're doing, changes your relationship to the challenges that arise in the practice. Changes your relationship to all the unwholesome mind states that can arise in the practice. Because one of the functions of this practice is it undercuts self-involvement. There's much more to be said about how this works, and that's for another talk. But very briefly, as we go through the categories, it levels the ground of preference. And of course, preference is always rooted in me, how this being relates to me. Are they nice to me? Are they mean to me? Do I love them? Do I not love them? Whatever. It's always about me. So it levels the ground of preference. In the four Brahma Viharas chant that we do in Pali, there's a line in there, to all as to myself. And that's an articulation of this. When the metta is strong, when the metta is powerful, we experience this open-hearted well-wishing for ourself, for our enemy, for all beings, to be completely the same. There's no difference. Suddenly we're not in the center of the universe and everybody else is out there, somehow less important. It undercuts that self-involvement that results in all those preferences, likes and dislikes. It removes that self-centeredness. And the experience of that kind of impartiality is profound. I'll never forget the first time I felt it. It was so visceral and so surprising. It's like, wow. No difference. That kind of impartiality profoundly and powerfully turns the mind towards an understanding of anatta, not self. That universal characteristic of all phenomena that we so deeply understand in the Vipassana practice, albeit in a different way. So it turns the mind towards that characteristic of not self, as well as deepening whatever insights we may have already had into it. And what's so wonderful about this in the metta practice, and this, I really love this practice, I have to say, and I'm coming to saying this from a place of really hating it, viscerally hating it. So the benefit and the wonderful thing about this is when we understand vipassana anatta in the vipassana practice, it's often because the mind kind of takes experience and dissects it into such small pieces. There's nothing there that can in any way be considered me. It's just empty phenomena flowing on. And that's a very deep way of getting an insight into anatta. But in the metta practice, as I said, we enter the doorway of this through conventional reality. And what's so wonderful is that there's this very natural integration that then happens, because we're using all our relationships with people to develop the metta. So my enemy, and you know, all the stories that can come up around our enemy, around me and mine and them and blah, 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 blah. When we get to this place of evenness and impartiality to an enemy, that understanding of not self is automatically integrated into our regular everyday life. So the next time we meet our enemy, it's a different experience. So we come to anatta from the opposite direction, as in the Vipassana. And it's a direction that is naturally integrating into everyday life. So our insights into anatta become alive and vivid here and now in the middle of this conventional life. The Buddha said very clearly, he said, it's in this fathom-long body that we wake up. So we can't just go to that place of absolute reality and abide there and expect to completely wake up. We have to integrate this whole other half, this conventional half, this form that's sitting here that has a name and a country and relationships and complexity. And it results in this beautiful acceptance of people the way they are when it's developed. Of course, maybe we slip off into old habits. But when we really, really deeply get that experience of evenness, we're never so caught again in that reactivity. And there's a much deeper acceptance of everybody's, including our own, foibles, flaws. We're human beings. So there's a much greater acceptance of that externally. And here's where it's quite wonderful, but also internally. This understanding of evenness, of acceptance, also influences our attitude towards whatever states are arising in the practice. And this is another aspect of how the metta practice supports vipassana practice. We're cultivating friendliness. This is the nature of metta. And the story that Sayadaw told yesterday, the framing story of the Metta Sutta, can be taken literally as an actual story that occurred to actual people. You can also take it as a metaphor for what happens when you sit down and try to practice. Internally. Because let's face it, we're all haunted. We're haunted by causes and conditions and past habits and past experiences and past things that happen in relationships or whatever is happening in our life right now or what we're afraid of might happen in the future. We sit in this place and we bring the whole world with us. And we're haunted. But like those monks who went running to the Buddha and he said, sorry, go back there. It's the only place you can wake up. We can't run away, can we? You know, you can't just say, ah, well, never mind, I'm going to go do something else. Because wherever you go, the mind goes with you. Instead, when we do this practice, we open to care, to friendliness, to well-wishing, no matter what. And when these difficult experiences that can arise in the practice come up, and when they're mine, they can be discouraging, they can be frustrating, they can be depressing, they can be a source of doubt. But when we can rest with that acceptance of the metta heart, that acceptance that sees them just as impersonal process, then we can work with them, whether we're doing the metta practice or the vipassana practice. When the metta is strong for ourselves, and when there's a strong metta attitude toward whatever is arising, there's no longer the tendency to resist difficulties, to resist unwholesome mind states as problems that somehow we have to get rid of. There's no longer the tendency to try to make them go away. Because there they are. Now what? May I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. And we just hold them in this beautiful field of metta. Instead, we have the inner space to just feel, to know them as they are, to not run away from them, to connect. There's a profound shift that comes in the Vipassana practice when we can do this. Because we're no longer trying to be someone other than who we are in this very moment. We can just, oh, aversion has arisen, restlessness has arisen, and we look at that. Oh, hello, restlessness. You know, we have that friendly attitude. What is this? And we're not resisting. So not only can we see this, whatever this happens to be, as it really is, but we're, by not resisting it, we're actually not feeding it either. So we're unplugging from that unwholesome mind state. We can see it as it really is. We learn something about the way things are as a result of that, rather than making it a huge problem that has to go away so that we can have good practice or some little experience. All of this, in this fathom-long body, all the things that can come up in the mind are the ground of our awakening. And we can access those rather than inclining to equanimity and, oh, there's a little fear, okay, that's not important, inclining to something else. Instead, we can go, oh, fear. What is it? How does it behave? What's its nature? It's no longer the monster under the bed, you know, that we kind of keep away. So that when we have a metta attitude, this is what Sayadaw was referring to when he said yesterday, you can't successfully do Vipassana practice without metta. You have to have this acceptance, this willingness to just be in the middle of this whole thing and see it as it is. Connect with it, feel it, know it. Right now, right here, without having to do anything differently, without having to be anyone different, without wanting to go to Nibbana in a hurry so that it, you know, it all goes away. And this is the way we get there, by diving in. So as the result of all this, we're more relaxed. We're more able to accept the presence of faults because they just become objects to be investigated. We're more able to rest with that kind awareness in all those places of inner challenge where there's fear, vulnerability, aversion, doubt. We're more interested. This is friendliness. You know, when you're friendly, you're interested in somebody. We're more interested. What is this? You're less goal-oriented. Nibbana will take care of itself in this way. We don't have to keep trying to get there. This is the secret weapon of Vipassana practice. Matthieu Ricard, who is just a wonderful Tibetan teacher, calls this quality of sati that's imbued with this friendliness, this metta, as warm awareness. I really like that. And Ajahn Brahm calls it kindfulness. When I first read that, I thought, oh, I wish I'd thought of that. Both really capture what this is. And we develop this in the metta practice when something comes up and we can just go, we get a little bigger with the heart and we say, well, may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. That anyway, you know, it's like, well, I'm not well, happy, and peaceful in this moment, but may I be well, happy, and peaceful. Not trying to push that away. May I be well, happy, and peaceful, no matter what. Accepts the fact that it isn't always easy or pleasant or blissful or nice. And in fact, some of the most onward-leading practice is the most uncomfortable. So may I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. Having metta like this is our kind of background operating system is what makes the Vipassana practice genuinely possible. And we can have been doing the Vipassana practice for decades and really notice a profound shift in how we relate to objects when we first come to an intensive metta retreat. It really does open a door because it's non-resistance. And that metta operating system is what gives us the internal space to hold the understanding of dukkha, the first noble truth. I'm smiling because the Buddha, in his first teaching, spoke about the Four Noble Truths, and the first noble truth being the noble truth of suffering. And the reason I smile is, at least from my own experience, that's the last thing I wanted to connect with when I came to this practice. Forget that. No, and I often kind of, I'd be reading a book and I'd flip through the first couple of pages where it talked about the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, because that was just basic stuff I didn't need. I wanted to get to the real stuff. The first noble truth is the noble truth of dukkha for a reason, because it's our doorway in to freedom. And having that metta operating system is the key to that door. It allows us to go through that door and not be shaken, to just rest with what is. And we get this through the metta bhavana. And it happens because here in this metta practice, we're forced to engage in all that stuff. Because we're entering the door of the Dhamma through conventional reality, we can't avoid it anymore. You know, we can't just take it apart into bits as though we don't feel it. There it is. And we practice with it. So if the practice gets bumpy, you're not doing anything wrong. This is the way it's supposed to be. But we work with it differently here. We work with these different difficulties in a different way here than we do in the Vipassana practice. So I want to spend a little time at the end of the talk now to speak about that briefly. Because both Vipassana Bhavana, as I've said, and Metta Bhavana act to purify the heart, but in different ways. So when we encounter challenges, I really like, Sayadaw has these wonderful metaphors. The way he speaks of how to work with difficulties in the Vipassana practice, he says, just watch Vipassana TV. You know, just sit back, relax, and let it all in the context of the metta practice, he uses another technological metaphor, metta aircon, air conditioning, which I also like. You know, when you walk into a hot room, and think about if you've ever been here in Burma in August, or I mean in April, it's like August in, you know, some other hot places. The room is stifling, it's really hot. You switch on the air conditioner, you do not immediately get cool and peaceful. No, it takes a little time. But little by little, the room gets cooler. And eventually you realize, oh, it's really comfortable in here. When did that happen? That's kind of how the metta aircon works. We start repeating the phrase, and it doesn't feel like anything's happening. But eventually, there is that purification. One, the metta practice, embraces, the other uproots. So the metta practice works with difficulty by holding it and just keeping going with the metta. The other takes it apart and uproots it with insight. Not to get confused, there's really strength to both practices. It's not either or. One's not better than the other. Yes, vipassana leads to liberating insight, but metta is what allows that to happen. So the metta style of working with difficulties is to embrace them, to acknowledge them kindly with a metta attitude, with a friendly attitude, to feel them, to acknowledge that they're there, not to go into the middle of them, just to set them aside and keep inclining the mind to metta. It's like having a big metta container that we allow these things to rest in. So the metta style embraces. The vipassana style, when with the uprooting, we investigate, we go into the middle of things. We see them as they really are. In the vipassana practice, we pay attention to things like kilesa, unwholesome mind states, difficulties, in order to understand them. And it's this understanding that leads to liberation. In the metta bhavana, we pay attention in order to care. Really briefly, it's like, can we care about our experience? Can we be friendly with it? These are very different tactics, but of course complementary. In a book that Sayadaw wrote that Ariya translated, Sayadaw speaks of the spirit of metta, and I think Ariya will probably describe this in more detail, but I want to pull one aspect out of this. Sayadaw speaks of the spirit of metta only seeing and looking at the good side. It never dwells on faults. It never sees and looks for faults. So we don't obsess with difficulties as faults, as problems. This manifestation of metta is what creates that inner space of being able to just be with something. It's no longer a problem, a fault, an issue. So in metta bhavana, all we need to do is acknowledge and rest in the metta and keep inclining to the metta. And as I've already said, kind of tangentially, it's natural in the metta practice that anything that isn't metta will come up to be experienced. This is the purification of metta. It's like here in Burma when you put your dirty clothes into a bucket of soapy water, sometimes there's this scum that rises to the surface and you see how dirty your clothes were. It's like, ugh. I came to develop metta, and it's like, you know, yuck, I didn't know that was there. This is normal. Please don't worry if this happens to you. This is part of the practice. And often we encounter states that are close to the edge of where we're comfortable or think we can rest with any balance at all. And for the vast majority of us, avoidance has been the usual default way of dealing with these things, to mitigate the pain of these states, to mitigate the intensity of these experiences. But the metta practice only deepens and grows by extending ourselves to these places where we think, I'm not sure I can be there. where we don't feel comfortable, where reactivity arises. We can't just rest in a place of, you know, concentration and pleasant open-heartedness. That's not what this practice is actually about. That can happen sometimes, and it's great when it does. But when we encounter these edge states, when the cultivation of metta is bringing these things up, this is where we begin to extend our capacity to rest in metta by just holding it, as I described earlier. Just hold it. Just keep radiating the metta. May I be well, happy, and peaceful anyway. The trick is not to try to fix or change what we're experiencing. A metta attitude is disarming. So to put down the weapons of the heart that want to fight experience, it's non-resistance. But without capitulation, without giving in, but it gives space for these experiences to be there and to be known with an open-hearted friendliness. So when we're cultivating metta, it's not about forcibly suppressing anything that isn't metta. That's a use of energy that never goes anywhere useful, except exhaustion. It's not about forcibly suppressing unwholesome mind states. It's just finding a way to hold them in a metta container. Finding a way to open the heart to the entirety of our experience and resting against whatever internal edge we're experiencing without resistance. And those experiences that most deeply challenge us in the practice, whether they be anxiety or fear, vulnerability, or deeply seated conditioned habits, these are the ones that mostly we have before tried to fix or change. Instead, the metta practice gives us the means to embrace, to accept, and to cultivate metta anyway. And going back to speaking about that interrelationship between metta and vipassana, that's what changes the vipassana practice. Once we have this foundation of metta, we can rest against our edges much more easily, much more naturally, and in much more relaxed way. And there's that ability to open to the truth of the way things are right here and right now, rather than having an agenda of how we want things to be. So metta bhavana, vipassana bhavana, these two beautiful practices, is profoundly different, but intricately interwoven practices that can't be teased apart. Both are profoundly good. And developing skill in each complements and benefits the other. I sometimes think of the metaphor of having two beautiful horses, different colors, They look really different, but they're pulling together. And, you know, when you have a cart pulled by two horses, you can go a lot further and faster than you can with one. And they're working in tandem. They're working together in unity. Not to be black or white, black and white about vipassana versus metta. As different as these practices are, once you look at the actual mind states of metta and sati and how these practices go together, you realize, oh, well, yeah, it's not one or the other, but both. Sometimes people read the Satipatthana Sutta with a kind of agenda, and they translate. There's a line in there, Ekayano ayam bhikkhave maggo. Bhikkhus, this is the blank way. I would translate that as the direct way, but some people say this is the one way. You can only do it like this. But when you experience the way these two practices of vipassana and metta go together, you can no longer go back to that place of vipassana fundamentalism. I used to be a vipassana fundamentalist. It's like, this is the only way. That's really stupid. I thought that. I was wrong. So the vipassana satipatthana is the direct path. And sati and metta pull together to take us to freedom. And this is what those 500 monks learned from the Buddha when he sent them back to that scary place. And I could only imagine, it's like, no, you got to go back there, guys, sorry. And it's like, oh, no. No, don't make us go back there. But nope, that's the only way you can wake up. Go right into the middle of that scary thing. But here's your protection. Here's your weapon. So it's by developing the metta that we discover this for ourselves. So I want to close with a lovely verse from the Jatakas. It says, just as water cools both good and bad and washes away all impurity and dust, in the same way you should develop thoughts of metta to friend and foe alike. And having reached perfection in metta, you will attain enlightenment. So may we all attain perfection in metta and attain enlightenment in the shortest possible time. Thank you for your kind attention, everybody.